This is The World Tonight. Good evening. I'm Douglas Edwards, CBS News. Who leaked the House Committee's secret report on the CIA? That's the question disturbing the Ford White House tonight, just as a similar one about the Pentagon Papers disturbed the Nixon White House. President Ford offered the help of the FBI today in solving the mystery. Bob Schieffer reports.
The White House will offer Speaker Carl Albert the full resources of the government if Albert wants to track down the leaks. That from White House spokesman Ron Nesson, who says the president is convinced the leaks came from Congress and not the executive branch. But tonight, the committee's staff director, Searle Field, said he's convinced just the opposite is true.
I point out that there are hundreds of copies in the executive branch, and if the president is sincere about plugging leaks, I would begin in the executive branch. I would also begin with probably the number one leaker in the executive branch or in the government, and that is simply Henry Kissinger, the high senior official on the secretary's plane.
What apparently triggered the president's new concern was a publication yesterday by the Village Voice, a New York weekly, of what is said to be virtually the entire report compiled by the Pike Committee. The paper won't say where it got the report, but the Washington Post says CBS News correspondent Daniel Schorr was instrumental in transmitting it to the paper. Schorr has broadcast a series of reports said to be based on the report, but tonight he declined to comment, he said, until we get a better idea of where the government intends to go with this. Speaker Albert, meanwhile, was said to be pondering the president's offer, but as yet has made no decision. Bob Schieffer, CBS News, Washington.
As it happened, Secretary of State Kissinger had a news conference scheduled today, and when the questions turned to the leaking of news, he became rather emotional and brought up a word from the past, McCarthyism. Bernard Kalb reports.
Kissinger took off his diplomatic gloves when he was asked about charges in a Pike Committee secret report as published in a New York weekly newspaper.
The use of classified information in a manner that is so distorted that the total impact is to produce a malicious lie. And therefore, even where documents in themselves are correct, they are taken so out of context that we are facing here a new version of McCarthyism.
Kissinger was also asked at which point it might become necessary to consider resignation given the controversies between himself and his critics.
If I should conclude that it is in the interest of American foreign policy, I would step down.
But he gave no hint of resigning, noting that his itinerary calls for a visit to Latin America next week and Africa later in the year. Bernard Kalb, CBS News, Washington.
A bomb exploded today in a guest house on the grounds of San Simeon, the fabled estate built by the late William Randolph Hearst on a hilltop overlooking the Pacific. No one was hurt. The prosecution continued its case against Patricia Hearst today. We have a report from Richard Threlkeld.
Prosecutor James Browning's key witness so far has been the teenager who was kidnapped and spent a day and a night with SLA survivors William and Emily Harris and Patricia Hearst in Los Angeles after the bank robbery. Tom Matthews said Miss Hearst freely admitted her part in the robbery, but added he thought Miss Hearst and the Harrises were, quote, some of the nicest people he'd ever met. What the court heard today was testimony from a long line of FBI agents who'd found a weapon and Ms. Hearst's fingerprints on some weapons manuals at the house where the Harrises were living when arrested last September, and at another house where Ms. Hearst was captured an automatic weapon, which was apparently the same gun Ms. Hearst allegedly used to shoot up a sporting goods store in Los Angeles. Prosecutor Browning plans to end his case before the jury no later than tomorrow morning with a flourish, playing the tape recording in which Miss Hearst says she willingly joined in the bank robbery and giving the jury one last slow-motion glimpse of her movies in the bank. And with that, the prosecution will rest its case. Richard Threlkeld, CBS News, San Francisco.
The federal government released its fifth annual report on marijuana and health today and took a more decisive stand than it has in the past. Bernard Shaw covered a news conference by Dr. Robert DuPont, head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse.
There's apparent disagreement between Dr. DuPont and President Ford, who says because scientists dispute marijuana's effect, possession penalties should not be reduced. At a news conference, DuPont said rather than threaten pot smokers with prison, they should be fined $25. He contended that marijuana is less dangerous than cigarettes or alcohol.
Alcohol really does kill people from overdoses through respiratory suppression. The public does not understand this, but many people in the United States are dying all the time from overdoses of alcohol. that marijuana is not that kind of a drug. In fact, the most single, most striking characteristic about the drug is the low toxicity in terms of death. It is virtually impossible to die from the use of marijuana.
DuPont said parents of pot-smoking teenagers should not get so terribly uptight, but instead talk with them about the health hazards. Bernard Shaw, CBS News, Washington.
A progress report from Lebanon tonight. Money has taken precedence over bullets, at least for the moment. Mike Lee has a report.
Lebanon took another bandage off of its healing wounds today. Beirut's private banks reopened after being closed during 2 months of heavy fighting. Now, with the ceasefire holding and a political agreement close at hand, the bankers opened their vaults as a show of faith and a gesture to hundreds of foreign businesses that it's now safe to return their headquarters and their dollars to Beirut. The big money may be a while in coming, but the banks were doing a brisk business this morning among local merchants and residents. There was no limit on withdrawals, yet there was no unusual run on money as some had feared, with bankers calling it a normal business day. However, the word normal might be stretching it a bit. Army tanks circled the financial district and scores of heavily armed government troops lined the street and in many cases searched customers going in. The bankers were delighted with the army show of force. Mike Lee, CBS News, Beirut.
Stocks on the downward side today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed around 967, down 5.12 on a volume of 28,610,000 shares. The average price per share down 13 cents on the New York Exchange, up 6 cents on the American. Wall Street on this world tonight. The president of Italy swore in a new government today, and just about everyone concerned had been through it all at least once before. Not very many new faces, not much hope of new initiatives in Italy's economic crisis. Winston Burdett takes a look at the future.
With the creation of a new government, Italy's long political crisis has not been resolved, but only postponed. No other government here since the war has had such an unhappy birth or faced such an uncertain existence. It is a one-party government without a parliamentary majority, which must depend on the promised abstention of fickle adversaries in order to survive. Nothing has been resolved in the stormy relations between the various parties of the democratic center, and that is why the Christian Democratic Party is now governing all alone. That this government was formed at all is due to the patience and persistence of one man, the Prime Minister Aldo Moro. And the 5 long weeks that it took him to do it have left a trail of rancor and resentment among the fighting party factions. With his reshuffled team of tired ministers, Moro must now try to steer Italy through her heaviest economic crisis. When he presents his austere emergency program to Parliament, the key point to watch will be the extent to which both his program and his government must rely not on his presumed democratic friends, but on the benevolence of the communists. Winston Burdett, CBS News, Rome.
The voice of the candidate is loud in the land now, and each day produces some new accent, some new issue, some new approach. Bill Plant takes us to the land of the nonconformist tonight.
Concord, Massachusetts is proud of its heritage of independence, of the free thinking of Thoreau and Emerson, who wrote that whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. Carl Valleca is something of a nonconformist. He is running for a seat on the town board of selectmen as a law and order candidate. But his address is the state penitentiary at Concord, where he is serving 20 to 32 years for robbery, as an accessory in the theft of the $250,000 Paul Revere silver collection, and as an accomplice in the armed robbery of 25 crapshooters. Valleca, in prison now for 7 years, is a trustee, eligible for furlough time outside the prison. He used some of it the other day to hold a Meet the Candidate night in Concord.
I am a member of a group of men who are taxed but have no form of representation. What better place than Concord to begin a new chapter on the rights of human beings? Some people might ask, why should a convicted felon be allowed to run or to represent anyone? I run because the law says it is so. Because the law has seen what taxation without representation will produce.
Valleca maintains that since prisoners pay sales taxes, they should be represented, a view which is met with a certain amount of skepticism in town, though many agree that he has the right to run. Massachusetts is one of 3 states in which prisoners have the right to vote. 301 of the inmates at Concord recently registered to vote in Concord, raising some fears that they could become an important influence in the town. Carl Valecca thinks that win or lose, his candidacy is all for the good.
Shock is good for the soul. A lot of controversy brings progress. You know, different points of view. It's what made America great. Let me put it this way. Apathy is no longer existent in Concord. The people are talking about elections, town elections, which is something that never happened in these small towns. The papers, the business is booming in the papers. And the inmates are talking. That's another big thing. You got young inmates talking about, well, what does he stand for and what does this one stand for? But if this could be the catalyst to some kid, when he gets into that booth, to say, today I'm as good as President Ford. I vote and it counts for one. And that's all Gerald Ford can do. Might be the catalyst that might turn some kids' heads because he's responsible. That day, he's as responsible as anybody in the United States.
If Valecca has done nothing else, he has probably assured tremendous voter interest in the April town election. Based on last year's low turnout, he could easily win with several hundred votes. Valecca says that if he is elected, the voters will always know where to find him. Bill Plant, CBS News, Concord, Massachusetts.
President Ford has done what he thinks all presidential candidates should do. He's released a complete financial breakdown. Net worth, $323,489, mostly real estate. Cash in the bank, $1,239, and not saving a penny in the White House. And that's The World Tonight, Thursday, February 12th. This is Douglas Edwards, CBS News.